So I think we should go ahead and get started. Welcome all to Q&A from the Ottawa PC User Group. As always, we welcome guests. If you want to join, that's great, but don't feel obliged to do so. A link to where you can join has been pasted into the chat. Later on this evening, we will have the contents of the chat window, the deck in a PDF format, and the audio track will go up on our website. I will now mute all. You will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. If you have any questions or comments, please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. And with that, Alan, take us through tonight's tech.
Okay, thanks, Chris. As you say, we have a lot of items, so I doubt we're going to get through everything, but I'm going to send it right back to Chris because he has a share about blocking ads.
Yeah, this is a really quick one. I was looking through the material I had sort of set aside for Q&A, and I came across this that I had actually done a note about, but I'd never done up the slides. So we all hate ads and trackers and things like that when we're surfing the web. And if you want a reason to block ads, trackers, etc., all you have to do is, next, install Brave, because the default tab for new tabs in Brave actually gives you a listing of how many trackers and ads they've blocked, the bandwidth that's been saved, and the time that's been saved. And this was after using Brave for less than 1 hour. It had actually blocked 1,658 trackers and ads, and it listed some of the biggest offenders, CNN, MSN, New York Times, and so forth. So just a brief overview there, I guess, of just how bad the problem is of trackers and ads. And Brave, of course, is happy to help do the blocking. There are other solutions as well, but I just thought this was an interesting stat to come up after 1 hour. That's it.
One of the problems with ad blockers is sometimes sites can see the ad blocker and won't display anything for you.
Yeah, it's true.
I haven't figured a way around that one yet.
Brave has been pretty good at any time that I've used it. I don't think I've been missing any real content, but who knows?
Okay, thanks, Chris. You're up next, too. You have a share here which interests me and probably interests a lot of folks.
Yeah, this is kind of cool. Casting your Windows desktop to a TV. This is as opposed to having to plug in an HDMI cable or something like that. And Windows Intelligence, which is a new newsletter website and so forth, that just came out, they had an article on just how easy it is to actually project your desktop to your smart TV over Wi-Fi. And I thought, well, it can't really be that easy, can it? Next. Now, it is worth noting, my TV is pretty simple. It's a 50-inch 4K Sharp brand Roku TV. It was only about $400 on sale 2 years ago. And I think that any smart TV should probably work. And I think most laptops should be able to cast to a device like a TV. Certainly Windows 10, Windows 11 shouldn't have any problem. And I'll paste that URL into the chat in a moment. Next. So to set it up, all you have to do is in Windows 10 or 11, you press the mnemonic for casting, Windows K, because somebody can't spell. Next. And then it'll come up on your laptop with a screen that says connect, and it'll search for wireless displays and audio devices that are within range of your laptop. And you can see on here, it came up with just generic, it said TV, and it was going to do it as a display. And all you have to do is click on where it says TV display, and next. Then you'll get a prompt on the TV, which actually asks if you want to allow that particular computer to cast to a TV. And you have to use the TV remote for a couple of minutes. I was very frustrated as I was trying to use my remote, and it turned out I was using my Rogers Ignite remote rather than the TV's remote to actually accept it. So you can always allow or allow just this one time. So next. And then your desktop appears on the TV. And you can see here I have a PowerPoint file and a text editor up, and you can see it's my full Windows desktop that you see on the screen. So next. At the top, you'll have this toolbar that's in the center of the screen, and it says connected to TV, whatever it identified that device as. And next, you have an option there to do a disconnect. And that will, as it tells you, just disconnect so that you're no longer casting to the TV. Next. You can also go in and you can unpin the toolbar, which is actually kind of useful if you're trying to watch a movie or something. You don't necessarily want that toolbar to be taking up real estate on the screen. And if you unpin it, the toolbar completely disappears. And then you might think, oh, well, how do I do my disconnect now? If you do that Win plus K, the mnemonic for casting, you'll get an option to disconnect. So it'll be a panel over on the right-hand side, and there'll be an option there to disconnect. So very easy to work with. I had no problem on very modest equipment. Anybody who has the need to display your Windows desktop on a smart TV, try it out. Works really well for me. That's it.
Thanks, Chris. Moving along, it's time for Stuart to chip in with another one of his favorite YouTube tech channels.
Hello again. Yes, one of my favorites. One of the ones I respect anyway. This is Gadget Byte is a channel that doesn't focus on the best, latest, and greatest. There's a strong emphasis on the mid-range and even sometimes budget phones and mobile devices. But they do talk about, excuse me, I'm not imagining flies. they lost my train of thought. Budget, mid-range, and the occasional high-end device. The wearables are mentioned quite a bit, too. You will find quite a few references to Chinese phones and other things that we don't normally see in North America because the review team is based in Kathmandu, Nepal. So they are kind of in the middle of everything. For them, not for us. The currency may be a little hard to translate into terms we can understand, but the reviews are good. They're reasonably honest. I think there's I know the main the host of the review channel has a preference for Apple devices, but it's very rare to see them push an Apple device over another one. They're quite impartial. And they often compare devices in the same price range so that you get reviews of phones we don't see, review comparisons of phones we don't see here very often. It's worth checking out. It's maybe two, sometimes three videos a week, so it won't fill up your schedule. Gadget Byte, check it out.
Okay, thanks, Stuart. So our next item is actually from Jeff Dubois, who's on the call tonight, but he's in deepest, darkest Ontario, and his bandwidth won't, I don't think, will support this item. And basically, a lot of people are interested in AI these days, and Jeff's found this site which basically will generate videos. And so he tried it out, and as he says, in 10 minutes, he cranked out this video. Now, I'm going to try and play. I've got a short version, which we'll try and play right now. And there's a longer version, which is going to be posted. The full version will be posted on the website. So if the problem with Zoom seems to be sound, so I'm going to actually crank up my sound. And hopefully play this thing and see if it works. If you don't hear the sound very well, then download the video and play it locally, and I'm sure it will work just fine.
Welcome to the Ottawa PC Users Group. Our purpose is to serve not only our members, but also the community at large. Members consist of folks like you and me who have joined together to help one another optimize the use of computer technology. Our monthly meetings and weekly question and answer sessions consist of presentations given on a variety of topics.
Okay, so I think you can probably see there that Jeff has, I've got to find my sound now. Jeff's basically taken some text from the club's website, given it to this AI generator, and we have a young lady here telling us all about the good things about the club. Jeff said he's a bit disappointed with the inflection. Clearly, it is a very robotic-type delivery, but it's also early days, so you can see that this is going to be the future of video tutorials, maybe. Anyway, Jeff recommends it, and if anybody is interested in trying it out, I think the URL was on the previous slide, so go take a look and see what you can come up with. Okay, our next item is a question that came in from Carol. She's giving a presentation, but the projector that she's using only has VGA. And Carol's computer is a fairly new laptop, and it doesn't have a VGA connection. Fortunately, she kept her old laptop, which does have VGA, and she can use that. But the question was, if she didn't have a VGA connection, how could you output to a projector or some other kind of a second screen, for example, some other kind of projection device, display device? And the answer basically is from Chris and I, generally you use some kind of adapter, and there are all kinds of adapters available, and boxes and cables and all kinds of things. And one example here is a USB cable that goes to a VGA adapter, or alternatively you have a cable which will take you from HDMI to VGA. So, and that's just one example. Almost every display format is probably available with the appropriate adapter cable. Okay, our next item is kind of interesting. I don't know whether anybody's going to have an answer for it. It's coming from Mirza, and he wants to know about domaining. And domaining, he says, has become big business. It's hard to find good domains because most of them are already taken. .com is the most popular. And he's looking for a forum or a group where he can obtain some advice because he's a novice and he wants to know about buying and selling domains and about parking domains to earn revenue. And so I don't know if anybody actually knows anything about this. So just a quick overview of domaining. It's basically people who buy and sell domain names. So they're investing in domain names which they hope to sell and make a profit. That is either sell them outright or perhaps even lease them. And the other thing they do is they actually, as well as creating domains or buying domain names from a registrar, they actually buy used domains and then try to flip them, sell them to somebody else. So that's kind of domaining in general. Domain parking is when you register a domain name with a registrar, you pay an annual fee for the ability to use that domain name. You don't have to put up a website to use that domain immediately. Most of the registrars will let you what they call park it. So you basically have the domain on the registrar's web server and it's kind of available there. Some companies will also let you post advertising. So this is a way to get revenue. If people go to that domain and click through the adverts, then I guess you generate money. So those are kind of the things that Mirza's interested in. The only thing, there's lots of stuff online about domaining, more than I could spend time looking at. But one of them is called NamePros, and they claim to be the the world's largest community of domainers with more than 1 million members. So that might be a place to start. And if anybody else knows anything about domaining and domain parking, want to drop us a line to suggestion box, we'll pass it on to Mirza. Okay, next up we have a question about Chrome Authenticator. Right, so this is another thing which I don't actually use. I don't use Chrome Authenticator. This is from Orion, and he's been trying to renew his Nexus membership, and the key that he had, personal key, turned out to be invalid. But they won't make calls to Canada, so they won't send him a text message to give him an authentication code. So he looked at Chrome Authenticator, which is a web browser extension, and looked at some YouTube videos, but still couldn't get it to work. So if anybody knows how to use Chrome Authenticator, again, we'd like to hear from you. Just in general, Authenticator apps, I do actually use one, just not Chrome. This is one way of doing two-factor authentication. So in two-factor authentication, you generally have login credentials. So you have a username which you log on with, and then it wants a password. But the second factor is some kind of security code. So the app, an Authenticator app, will generate a code. And there are two different ways of doing it. One is called time-based one-time password, and the other one is called hash-based message authentication code. I'm only familiar with the time-based one. But basically, rather than using a smartphone to get your authentication code as a text message, what you do is the system will prompt you for the code, and then you run the app on your phone or on the desktop, and the algorithm in the app will generate the code. So for example, I actually use Sophos Intercept X on my Android smartphone. And here's the screenshot of the Authenticator app. And interestingly, they won't let me show you the actual codes that it's generating. No idea why, because they're one-time passwords and only good for like a minute. Anyway, that, when I try and do the screenshot, that's what I get. So I found a similar, this isn't exactly the same, but it looks like it's an old version of it. But here somebody set up for three different website type accounts, and the Authenticator app has generated three different one-time security keys, passcodes, and on the right-hand side is a counter which is counting down until this password is no longer viable. And once the thing counts down, it creates a new passcode immediately on the fly, and the counter starts counting down again. So that's basically how Authenticator apps are supposed to work. Here's the information on the US government. You can see that they do allow Authenticator. It tells you to open the browser and sign in, and then it says, follow the instructions to do this, that, and the other. So I guess the instructions are a bit difficult. So again, if anybody knows how to do that, we'd like to hear from you. And again, we'll pass that information along to Orion. Okay.
I could add a few comments if I have a moment.
Yes, go ahead.
There's actually two parts to the Authenticator app from Chrome, and one involves a QR code. So if you click on the in your upper right corner of your screen, the Authenticator app is sitting there as an icon, and you can click on half of it. It's supposed to generate a QR code, and I get the QR code, but the government website, which is the Trusted Traveler platform, doesn't recognize the QR code. The other part of the is an actual pencil icon, and when you click on it, it says you're supposed to manually handle the account, but the manual entry involves putting in an issuer and also a secret. and it doesn't explain how you come up with either the information for the issuer field. I've tried putting in the actual code for the website, but I don't know where the information comes from the secret field. Net result is while it's shown here as you have on your screen, the Chrome extension authenticator, it's just not working with the Trusted Travel program. So the net result is the only solution I have is to delete my account completely and start all over again.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a way. I just don't, you know, I don't use Chrome, so I don't know what it is. It strikes me the QR code is used to set up the platform with the app. So it's not actually the security code itself. It just lets you set up the app to talk to the website you're trying to get to through the app.
Well, my understanding is that the QR code is supposed to generate, if it's red, it should generate a 6-digit code, which would be the same as getting a text message.
Ah, okay.
And then that would authenticate your actual email address.
But that didn't do that.
You know, I've tried it so many times, I kept thinking, well, I must be missing something that needs to be done, but I can't figure it out. So that's why I said the question.
Okay, well, let's see if anybody comes up with an answer to that.
Thank you.
Okay, Chris is back, and he has a hardware share.
Yeah, this was kind of a fun one, actually. We had a presentation not too long ago from Bob Harris on a gaming mouse that he had purchased, which he was really happy with. Well, recently I bought a Lenovo mouse and keyboard combo, and I was much impressed with it. So it's the Lenovo Legion KM, which stands for keyboard and mouse, version 300, RGB. So it does our red, green, blue color combos. And it's a gaming mouse and keyboard. List price is $100. It's on sale right now for $63.19. And from my experience, it's actually on sale quite frequently. And it is free shipping from Lenovo Canada. So you can also get them separately. So if you just want a keyboard, you can get the Lenovo Legion K300 keyboard or the mouse, the M300. And the prices are there on the screen if you wanted just one or the other. But you do save a bit if you get them both as a combo. So Linda and I both have this keyboard. I bought the combo, the mouse and keyboard, but Linda has just the keyboard. And we both really, really like this keyboard. It's got a very solid feel to it. It's got a good heft to it. It's not going to slide around easily on your desktop or anything like that as you push on anything. If you press on it, it's very rigid. So it doesn't feel flimsy at all. The key presses, I find a very nice travel on the keys. They feel very positive. There's a nice click to it. It has great black backlighting, which I'll get into more detail on, and very, very customizable. And I'll get into more details on that. Next. And with Linda was the first one to get this keyboard. And she has problems with her keyboards that are cheap keyboards. And you can see the top rows, the 1, 2, 3, and so forth. The numbers on that and the letters on that are just decals that are stuck onto the surface. And Linda found these wore out. And so she was replacing the worn out key identifiers with these stickers that you could get that just go on top of the keys. Yeah, a little bit ugly, but it sort of works. But she was looking for something that was a little bit more robust, and certainly this keyboard is much more robust in its letters and so forth. Next.
Maybe Linda shouldn't be using 123 as a password. Last longer.
So
very funny. It was actually all the letters of my name wore out. Linda. I shouldn't sign emails. I should just pretend they're texts.
There are some hotkeys that come sort of built into the keyboard. So the function key plus F4 will allow you to cycle through three levels of backlighting, really two levels. There's no black lighting, dim, and a bright. The function key plus F5 will cycle through 6 different lighting patterns, and I'll talk about those in a minute. And there are some that are static, where they don't change, and there's some that are dynamic, where you'll have flowing colors going all the time. And then there's function plus F12, and that toggles on the game mode. And by default, what it does is it disables Windows key, presumably so that if you're in the middle of a game, you don't want to accidentally touch that key and have some, you know, the Windows start menu pop up and disrupt your gameplay. But really, that's just the start of things. So that's just the basics. Next. So if you download the Lenovo utility called Legion Access Accessories Central, it allows you to customize your colors and patterns. You can actually assign macros to any key. And this is truly, absolutely any key on the keyboard can be customized to put out something different than that particular keystroke. And I'll go into that a little bit. You can, on the mouse side of things, you can actually adjust the DPI or the dots dots per inch, or the sensitivity of how fast it moves across the screen, and the polling rate, which is how often that the mouse actually reports its current position to the operating system. And there's more that can be done as well. And there's the URL there for the download on it. Next. So for lighting, if you bring up that Legion, whatever it was called, I hate their naming on some of these things. But if you load up the utility, in my case, there's entries for the M300 mouse or the K300 keyboard. So if I click on K300 keyboard, on the right-hand side, you have a scrollable list there of things that you can do. Next. So the first thing you can do is change the keyboard lighting. And if you click on where it says the on my screen, it's saying static, so it's the mode that it is actually in. There's actually 6 different modes, and this is the 6 modes that will be scrolled through if you do the function F5. And so going through them, there's surfing, and that'll cycle through all of the colors, and the colors flow from the left-hand side to the right-hand side of the keyboard. You have breathing rainbow, where it actually cycles through all the colors. It doesn't flow from left to right. It just goes on and off, and it cycles through all colors, fading from no backlight at all to full brightness, same color across all of the keys. Then you have drifting, cycles through all colors, sweeping across the keys from the center out and back, rather than with surfing going from left to right. Static, you can have one solid color for the backlight. Static 5 zone, there are actually 5 different zones across the keyboard, and you can have a different color for each of the 5 zones. And then you can have breathing 5 zones, where the colors cycle through from no backlight to full brightness and back, and in each of the 5 zones, and you can choose the color for each of those 5 zones. Next. So I found it all very distracting, except for static, which is what I settled on, and I decided I'd go with. Static 5 zone is not too bad, because it is staying the same, but you would have 5 different colors across. Now, the weird thing is, it really is across the keyboard. I don't know why they didn't define the zones as, like, the letters, the function keys, numeric keypad. You know, zones sort of made sense in different colors, maybe, but they didn't. It is going across the keyboard. But to each your own. Try them out. If you get this keyboard, try out the different ones, and maybe you'll actually like some of the dynamic ones. Next. So then you can choose the color. So any of the ones that allow you to choose the color, such as static, if you click on the color square, it'll bring up a list of 35 different colors that you can actually choose from. And if that's not enough, next, you click on the more, and there you'll actually get 65 million colors, because it does any of 0 to 256 value, 255 value in red, green, and blue, coming up to 16 million possible color combinations that you can actually have.
Have you tried them all yet?
Yeah, right. So then if you scroll down from that first one where you have keyboard lighting, you scroll down, and then you have keyboard action. And this is where you can customize any key on the keyboard, and it truly is any key. You can assign either a media control, so this is when you're playing music or videos, whatever, it'll do the sound. So you can do play, pause. You can do previous track, next track, volume up, volume down, or mute. Or you can assign a macro to any key. Next. So for example, like nobody uses a scroll lock key. I presume there's probably some people who use it, but it's pretty rare. And so maybe you want to assign the mute to that key so that you don't have to reach over to your speakers or go to the control on the Windows taskbar or whatever. You can just do the mute on that. So next. So if you click on it, you'll get a drop-down menu where you have either macro or media or restore it to the default. So in this case here, I choose media, and then I get a fly-out menu with the different media controls. I click on mute, and from then on, I can mute or unmute my sound simply by pressing the scroll lock key. Kind of cool. Next. So you can also look at it as being assigning a macro to. So again, say I decided on the scroll lock key that I'm not going to use it for anything else, so I can assign a macro to it, which will be up to 30 key presses. And it truly is key presses. So if you hold down the shift key, that's a key press. The space is a key press. The caps lock key would be a key press, all of them. So, for example, if I wanted to have a press of the scroll lock key, would type in Chris Taylor, hit enter, and type OPCUG, I could do that. So how do we do it? Next. Again, I go to the scroll lock key, click it, and I choose, rather than media, I would choose macro. And then you get the flyout menu where you can record a macro for the scroll lock key. Next. You give it a name. In this case, I called it OPCUG signature. And notice that I haven't done it, but you can actually record mouse clicks and the mouse wheel. I'm not sure if it's an absolute position. Matters when you do a mouse click, or if you click on a particular named object on a screen, like an OK button, whether it actually records that you click the OK button. I haven't tried that. So I just did record. And then you type in what you want to have happen. So what I did was right shift, and notice that it actually records whether it's the left shift or the right shift, the left alt key, the right alt key, left control key, right control key, so forth. So it said I did the right shift key, I hit C, and then I typed in RIS and space. Now notice it doesn't actually tell me on here that I released the right shift key after the C, but we'll see that in just a second. So I carried on with that. I did Chris space Taylor enter, and then caps OPCUG, and then ended. So I just have the screen cap of the first few letters that I actually typed in. Next. So then I click on the next key, next button. And then it actually comes up with an opportunity to actually modify the macro that you actually recorded. And here it has absolutely everything. So you can see next. So besides having all of the key presses and the key releases, you can actually insert additional key presses. You can reorder key presses that are already listed, or you could delete key presses if you accidentally added some keystroke that you actually didn't want. Next. Over on the other side, it even records how long it takes for you to press and release keys. And when it plays back, it's going to use the exact same timings. So if you have something that is timing sensitive, it can actually incorporate that into the macro. Next. So you can actually click on any one of them to change the timing for that one press. So in this case, I had release right shift, and then before I did anything else, I actually waited for about a second and a half. So I could actually change that by clicking on there, entering any number that I actually want. Next. Or what I did was I reset all timings, and it comes up with a dialog box, and it warns you that they recommend to set it for 50 milliseconds minimum for normal presses, and zero, its keys are pressed together. I actually set them all to 5 milliseconds, and I had absolutely no problem. And it typed in my name, Chris Taylor, enter OPCUG, a lot faster that way. Next. So from then on, And it highlights the key they have assigned a macro to. And it tells you that what the tooltip will tell you what the macro is that is associated with that key. So I now know that I've assigned a macro called OPCUG signature to that. And when I press that key, it'll actually feed those into whatever the current app is. Next. Okay, the next one thing scrollable down in the list for keyboards is game mode. And remember I said at the start that by default it disables Windows logo key, so it prevents you from having the start menu pop up. So you can also have it that it will do Shift-Tab, Alt-Tab, or Alt-F4. It'd be terrible if in the middle of the game you accidentally hit Alt-F4 and end your game. So you can actually disable those so that when you're in a game, you can have all of those keys disabled, whatever ones you choose. You can also have profiles, which is listed down at the bottom there. And that's kind of neat because what you can do is have different profiles set up that you can select from. Unfortunately, there's no keystroke that you can use. I guess you could set up a macro, probably, that would actually switch profiles. But by default, you have to actually load the utility to select a profile. And so I have one, I renamed my default one solid green as the color of the keys that I have. But you can create additional ones and customize them. So, for example, you could have different colors for different times of the day or something like that. Maybe during the day you want brighter backlighting than at night. At night, maybe you want a soft blue or something like that, or by your mood. Or you can have different macros according to tasks. So you could have it if you're in PowerPoint. You could have different keystrokes will do different things in macros. Or if you're in Word, whatever you want, and just call up the profile when you want to use that particular function. Next. Then on to the mouse. So the colors, really there's only one. This is the tail light on the mouse. And it's just the Lenovo Legion logo. And it's lit up. And there are color options that are similar to the keyboard, but there's some that, like cycling through colors left to right, doesn't make sense and so forth. So there's a shortened list of the color options that you have available. Next. And then you have the mouse action. So there's a total of 8 buttons on this mouse. So there's the left and right mouse buttons. There's the wheel. There's the DPI button. By default, it's a DPI button just behind the wheel. And then you have 2 buttons on the left and 2 buttons on the right. And you can customize any of those. Next. So you just click on one of them. And like the keyboard, you can either assign a media control to it or you can assign a mouse function. So you can swap your left and right mouse buttons if you wanted or things like that. And next. Oh, sorry, go back one. Sorry, I jumped a little bit too fast. So you can also assign a macro or media function to any of those buttons you want as well. So if you don't use them as mouse button functions, like the right-hand side buttons, you could assign a media function to mute based on that or whatever macro you wanted assigned to it. So very customizable. Next. Then you get down into the DPI. So you can actually customize 3 DPI settings so that when you click that DPI button on the top of the mouse, it'll cycle through these 3 sensitivity settings. And you can customize any of them to however sensitive you want them to actually be. Next. And then finally, you can set the polling rate. And this is how often that the mouse reports to the operating system its position. And the higher the sensitivity, the more accurate things are going to be, but it does take a little bit more CPU cycles and so forth on your computer. I've got it set to the maximum of 1,000 hertz, so 1,000 times per second. It's actually reporting to the operating system, position my mouse, and so highly accurate. I haven't noticed any performance problems at all on it. Next. So the Lenovo Legion KM300 RGB gaming combo keyboard and mouse, I highly recommend it. Anybody who wants a highly customizable, good, solid keyboard at what I think is actually quite a reasonable price. And that's all I have on there.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Chris. Okay, so This is an item that is generated actually from a question that came in from a member. He says that his laptop takes a long time to open, and most of the time when it does, things are going around in a circle. So he's seeing the kind of pending circle in Windows. And then I have another friend who says, my Windows laptop is so slow, and she doesn't know what to do about it. So symptoms for slow hardware, slow computers can take a long time to boot up. Sometimes it takes long time to shut down as well. Your applications may take a long time to load. And if you're switching browser tabs, you may find that the information is loading very slowly. And even worse, that the computer either responds slowly or stops responding altogether to the keyboard and the mouse input, which is a problem. So the question is, what can we do to speed up slow computers? And the answer is, you need to listen to Chris in March of 2018, or actually go back to his club presentation from March 2018, when he talked about performance tune-ups for Windows, and there's a whole raft of things which he suggested you might take a look at. And in future sessions, we're going to come back to these. But in the meantime, Chris also noted in November last year that Microsoft had released this product called PC Manager. And it was supposed to give you a one-touch speed boost, one-click speed boost. And so I thought I would take a look at this thing. I recommended it to the member who was saying he had a slow computer, but I didn't hear back to see if it made any difference. So I thought I'd take a look and see what it does. So we'll start off tonight with a few things. And if you're interested in trying out PC Manager, this is Microsoft's website, the URL. And basically, you just download the software from the big blue button here and install it, and you're ready to go with true blue Microsoft software. Now, the problem was I had was finding an old computer that was really slow. So the best bet I have is my old desktop. And it's actually quite old. I bought it in 2011, so it's way more than 10 years old. But it does have a Core i7 CPU it came with 12 gigabytes of RAM. It also came with a 2 terabyte hard drive, which turned out to be 2 1-terabyte hard drives. So I took out one of the 1-terabyte hard drive and stuck in a solid state drive instead. And I've upgraded the solid state drive since. So now I've got a 250 gig solid state, which is basically running and the operating systems and my dedicated data partition. This thing is up to date. It's running Windows 10 Home. It's up to date in terms of Windows 10. It won't update to Windows 11. But it's running the latest feature release, which is the last release, 22H2 for Windows 10. And the boot time is 27 seconds. So that's from pressing the power button to the desktop lighting up. And personally, I don't think that's too shabby. I don't know whether people find that slow or what, but this machine actually works quite well, even given its age. So the bottom line, we're going to start off trying to clean up some junk files. So I thought I'd take a look and see what we've got. And I'm running a 60 gig partition for Windows Drive C. And right now I've got about 3.6 gigabytes are free. And when I run this cleanup, so that's looking at the properties of the C drive. When I run this cleanup, if I just run the regular disk cleanup, I'm getting 329 megabytes of temporary files which are available to go away. If I press on the cleanup system files, then it finds 104 megabytes of probably other files which could be deleted. So there's, about 400 meg of files there, which it says I can get rid of. Okay, so here's PC Manager up and running. I've installed it. And one thing I'll notice is that it's called public beta. So it's not a full release yet. It's in beta release. So you take that as it comes, but you're allowed to send feedback and try and improve it, I guess. Here's the main screen, the window on the left, and the various controls that you have available to you. You've got this big blue button that's called Boost, but it doesn't really tell me what Boost does. Remember, it's beta, right? There's a section called Health Check. There's one called Storage Management, Process Management, one to deal with startup applications. And then down the bottom there, there's a Cleanup button, which again, I don't really know what that does. And there's a Security button. And then finally at the top, there's a gear wheel, which is the settings app. So I always go for the obvious thing. So it says I've got 1.4 gigabytes of temporary files. So I'm going to hit Boost and see what happens and try and get rid of those and there we go. We hit Boost and it's got rid of 1.4 gigabytes of temporary files. They've gone to zero. And when I looked at when I pressed the button, it literally took like a second maybe to go from 1.4 gigabytes to zero, which clearly I would say is not possible. So whether it's doing things in the background, I don't know, but it says it got rid of 1.5 gigabytes. So I went back and I had a little look at disk cleanup, and you can see that nothing much has changed there. I've still got about 400 megabytes of temporary files which disk cleanup could get rid of. So again, I'm not sure what Boost is doing, what it's done, but let's go back. So let's go back and see what's happening. And now it says we've got 153 megabytes of temporary files. So it thinks it got rid of more than a gigabyte, and it's got 153 megabytes. So this time, rather than hit Boost, I'm going to hit the cleanup button and see what that does. And sure enough, when I hit that, again, it immediately drops to 0 kilobytes. So again, did it do anything or not? I don't really know. Let's go back and have a look at this cleanup. And the first one there, I didn't bother looking at the second one. It's still got its 300 meg sitting there waiting to go away. So I'm really not sure what these buttons are doing, if they're doing anything. So are you confused yet? This cleanup says we've got about 400 megabytes of files which we could delete. Boost said that it got rid of 1.4 gigabytes in next to no time, but this cleanup still has a whole bunch of stuff there. The cleanup button says it got rid of 150 meg, but again, I still have 400 meg in this cleanup. And the storage management section, it says it's 4.8 gigabytes, but it doesn't tell me whether those are files or free space or whatever it is. So I'm not sure what that is, but we'll come back to this later on and we'll check out some of those other sections. But so far, I don't think we're doing very well. I'm not terribly impressed. But we Alan, need to dig, I, a, bit, we need Alan, to dig a bit deeper.
I presume that you actually did reload disk cleanup.
I only loaded it to see what was there. I didn't actually run it.
No, yeah, but you did reload the program, right? Disk cleanup?
Yes.
And,
that's right.
Okay, yeah. And it was still reporting a lot. Yeah, because
I ran disk cleanup to see what was there. I ran Boost, and then I ran disk cleanup to see what was there now.
Yeah.
Nothing much changed.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of at all on that is that you don't have everything selected as possible for cleanup, and some of the things that it's saying it can clean up in disk cleanup is stuff that will not necessarily be done by PC Manager. For example, you've got delivery optimization files. I don't think that is handled by disk cleanup, PC Manager. And scrolling down, there may be other categories of things that you've got selected in disk cleanup that PC Manager was not designed to handle. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah. What I don't know is where's my 1.4 gigabytes, which it wants to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think if we look at that storage space, we'll get some more information. Anyway, we'll try that later on.
Yeah. Okay.
So in the meantime, we're at the magic last 10, I believe. So if anybody has any other questions or things that you'd like to share, now is your opportunity. Tom says to check the temporary directory on drive C.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that they're sort of opaque in PC Manager about what they're actually doing. Now, as Alan delves a little bit deeper, it becomes a little bit more transparent when you dig into some of the other options. But yeah, the upfront buttons that you actually have there of just saying clean up or boost, they really don't tell you an awful lot. Well, they don't tell you anything about what it is they're actually doing. As Alan delves deeper into storage management and process management, and I think health check, it does give you more information about what it's actually trying to accomplish. And my experience has been always, I never use boost or cleanup. I've always just delved into storage management, and it's always helped in that. And they do tell you in great detail about what is actually going on if you dig down that deeply.
Yeah, this is classic computer programming, isn't it? You write the routines, get the buttons to work, but you don't actually document what you did.
Yeah.
But it's beta software, so there is no help file right now. Hopefully somebody's going to tell them, hey, you really should document what this thing does, because it's not very useful if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah. We have a question. Deleting temporary files, any possible problems, or do we never need the temp files? That depends. As is a universal answer to all things IT related. First off, they won't delete any files or even attempt to delete any files that are currently in use. Usually they're locked for exclusive use, so they can't be deleted. Whether any of the files that are in your temporary directory are needed or not, usually they're not, but programs can use the temp directory for any purpose that they deem they want to use the temporary directory for. So there is potential there of having a problem. What I do, or tell people if you are concerned about that, what I recommend is that you reboot your computer and then run PC Manager or whatever it is that wants to delete temporary files. And I sort of figure if there's any files that are left there after a reboot, it's, you know, the likelihood of you actually needing them is probably pretty remote. So I think that's fairly safe. If you really want to be safe, what I do is I will go in and I'll manually clean up the temp directory. And to do that, the easiest thing is, let me just see if I can, in File Manager, I think on the address bar, if you just put in %temp%, it will take you to what is defined as being your temp directory, which in my case is /users/ctaylor/appdata/local/temp. That's the location of the temporary directory. And then I will delete any files in there or folders that are older than, say, a week or something like that. And that'll get rid of an awful lot of stuff with a high likelihood that anything that is needed will still be left behind. Personally,
I've never had any trouble deleting temporary files. And all of the options under disk cleanup, I just delete everything. Sometimes it doesn't delete everything, because I guess some stuff is still in the pipe and being used. And you'll get the same thing in the temporary subdirectory, where it won't delete everything because there are some files that are being used by the system, like right now. So it won't delete those.
So the way I'm sharing my file manager, and so you can see that you just on the address bar put in %temp%, and you hit enter, and it will take you to whatever is defined as your temporary directory. And then again, you can see Chrome has a wonderful thing where it creates temporary files, temporary folders. I have absolutely no idea what they're all about. On one photo raw, my photo editor is creating all kinds of temporary folders and things like that. And then I get down into the actual files, and you can see I haven't done a cleanup in a long time. If I go to temp and I go to the properties, you can see I have half a gigabyte of files in there. So I haven't been doing very much cleanup in the last while. I've got 780 files, 1,594 folders. So probably a good idea for me to do a cleanup at this point.
And so Stuart asked if I had tried BleachBit, and the answer is no, I didn't delete anything while I'm playing around with PC Manager. But I don't use Windows very much, so I just generally use disk cleanup or get rid of the temporary files. Tom says, where was it? Google Speed Up PC. What's Google Speed Up PC, Tom? You have to unmute your microphone. I noticed
your microphone
isn't working, and he's correct. It's not. Right. Send me an email and tell me what Google Speed Up PC is.
The next point you have there, if using a hard disk, turn on defragging in the disk properties tool and set it to daily. That's great if you are not doing incremental image backups. If you are doing incremental image backups, your incremental backup files will be huge or a lot larger than that. So if you are doing incremental backups, image backups, what I recommend is that you manually run a defrag just before you actually run a full backup. So when you're going to run a full backup, it doesn't matter because you're going to be backing up everything. But I never run defragging when I'm going to have an incremental backup going, because it moves files all over the place and your image backup files will get really big.
And as Tom notes, if you're using a hard drive, turn on defragging. If you're using a solid state drive, do not.
Yeah, I think Windows will prevent you from doing a defrag using their tool anyways, their defrag tool. It will not run on an SSD. So it knows if it's solid-state drive, and it won't run.
Yeah, Tom says for SSD, just use trim. But I think that's built into the operating system, so you don't really need to bother.
Yeah, it should do it by itself.
Yeah, see you all next week, Wednesday, August 23rd. And that's it for me.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.